Hi and welcome to A Dingo Ate My Movie, a podcast that features classic Ausploitation and other weird, wonderful, overlooked and underappreciated Australian films from the 70s, 80s and beyond. My name is Pete and I'm your host. All right, I'm joined today by a good friend of the podcast, Brandon Hardy. Brandon's been one of my most frequent guests, and it's always great to have him on the show. Welcome again, Brandon.
Hello, thank you again for having me yet once again.
I know, I was just thinking, we've done Man from Hong Kong, what else have we done? Frog Dreaming. It's been countless, almost too many to remember.
Yeah, I know. There was one, Next of Kin, yeah.
Next of Kin, of course. How could I forget that one? Today we're talking about BMX Bandits from 1983. It's an interesting movie. I guess it straddles the line between a kid's movie and a family movie. I think it leans more towards a kid's movie, but there's pretty much something in there for everyone to take away in some way, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when we get to more of the discussion points, I think it's worth puzzling over, yeah, like what kind of genre or subgenre is this, or is it drawing from lots of different other genres? And I think that even in Frog Dreaming, like there's a lot of interesting genre work at play, like borrowing a little bit of this from one and that from another, that I think makes it, you know, gives it some variety and creates some interest, I think.
I'll just go over the synopsis, a very quick synopsis. So three teenagers find a stash of walkie-talkies that belong to a criminal gang who are planning to use them in a robbery. With the criminals in pursuit, the teens must outwit them before it's too late. That's pretty much the whole thing. It's not much of a plot, and I think it's just kind of like a vehicle for 80 or 90 minutes of kids' movie, right? Kids' fun. BMX Bandits was released in December 1983. It stars David Argue, John Leigh, Nicole Kidman, Angelo D'Angelo, James Lugton, and Brian Marshall. And it was directed, of course, by Brian Trenchard-Smith, another one that I think probably my most I've done more episodes with Brian Trenchard-Smith as a director as anyone else on this podcast, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this could be a BTS podcast, essentially.
It could almost be that. We could get into all his other stuff, like Leprechaun 3 and all that
sort of stuff. Oh, sure, yeah. You got quite a catalog.
The film is available on Blu-ray from Umbrella Entertainment and streaming digitally in Australia on Netflix, Binge and Prime. I'm not sure if it's streaming in the US. Did you have a look at all, Brandon?
Yeah, I didn't find it streaming anywhere. I think it was on Plex.
Okay.
With ads.
With a million ads, yeah. The Blu-ray, of course, I always talk about Umbrella because most of the stuff that we talk about on this podcast, they have releases of. The Blu-ray that I got from them recently, I don't think it's a very new, like it's not a new release and it's not under their Ausploitation range or anything like that, but it's a really nice transfer and it looks really good. It's got some great extras. The commentary's interesting. It's got a little featurette and just a little bit of Nicole Kidman on Young Talent Time when she was like 16 promoting the film, which is quite interesting. The ratings for this film are interesting. Like on Rotten Tomatoes, it's got a 67% critic and a 54% audience score, 5.5 on IMDb and 2.8 on Letterboxd. So sort of, I don't think it's a very highly rated film.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty middle of the road, I would say. So I think those scores are pretty accurate, reflects the quality of the movie, I think.
Yeah, I think I gave it put it down for 2.5 or something on Letterboxd. So about middle of the road sort of thing. The film's probably best known for being one of Nicole Kidman's earliest forays into the cinema. At its core, it's a kids' film, but, you know, there's no reason adults won't enjoy this, you know, throwback to the 80s and the BMX craze in Australia.
So what was the BMX craze like in Australia? Like, I'm sure that there was something similar here in the States, because I remember seeing people dressed, you know, they're on bikes, but wearing like the helmets with the face masks in movies like Rad and Pee Wee's Big Adventure. But like, what was it like there? Was it really that big?
Well, I don't remember it, but in 83, I was 21 and I was touring Queensland in an Elvis show. So I wasn't really exposed to BMX very much, I guess. I do remember bits of it, but I don't really remember anything out of the ordinary. When I was growing up, BMX wasn't a thing. I think when I had a bike, it was a dragster, a good old dragster from those days. That would have been the 70s. But I think the reason this film did reasonably well in Australia and in Britain, and surprisingly in Japan, was that BMX had kind of taken off a bit earlier here and in those countries than it did in the US. And it didn't play as well in the US early. And I think movies like Rad that came a bit later, sort of on top of the whole BMX craze in the US, probably did a bit better. But I don't really remember. I mean, I see lots of kids on BMX bikes now. And I imagine the standard of riding in BMX is a lot better than it is in this movie, by the expert riders. So it's obviously in its infancy when you see this film. But
even by the end of the film, when you have hundreds of children on BMX bikes, and it's you're like, wow, this is like a fantasy. Like, I've never seen anything quite like this in my life.
Yeah, when you see all the kids, and yeah, it's it's really cool. But it's interesting. It just takes you back. I think Brian Trenchard-Smith in the commentary, or in maybe one of the little featurettes on the Blu-ray, was talking about it's kind of an idealized sort of world that we'll probably never go back to, that sort of era, you know, with kids.
Yeah.
You know, kids don't play outside as much anymore. I don't want to put my old man's hat on, but kids don't play outside anymore as much as they used to. I'm sure they still do. I still go past the skate park just up the road here. I drive past there and always see kids there on the skateboards or on their, you know, on their bikes in there. But it was definitely a different time. But, you know, we can't always go back. We just got to live with what we have now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really here, I think the only thing I normally see is like kids on skateboards and the occasional bike, but usually they're just, you know, they're doing tricks in parking lots and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much now. Like I said, I'm sure just a kid down the road is a bit more advanced in riding than they are in this movie. But that's evolution for you. Some of the A Dingo Ate My Movie alumni, we just mentioned Brian Trenchard-Smith. We've sort of done one, two, three, five of his movies to date, so quite a few of them. David Argue, who is really funny in this film. I think he's really good, and he's a lot of his role in this film is improvised, and they just kind of made up as they went along. He was in Razorback. We covered him in Razorback, and he was really good in Razorback. Completely different role in that movie, because in this film he's just like a bumbling criminal. And in Razorback, he's quite a nasty piece. I don't know if you've seen that movie.
I haven't seen that one yet. I've been meaning to pick up the Blu-ray.
Right. He's very good in that. And like I said, he's quite a nasty character in Razorback. And then John Lay, I think, who is his partner in crime in this film, was in Turkey Shoot, and actually he was in Mad Max as well. So a bit of a thing there. And also, I didn't write it in my notes, but I think it's John Searle, the cinematographer or the photographer of this film, director of photography. He's done all sorts of stuff like Mad Max, Man from Hong Kong, heaps of things like that, Fury Road, stuff like that. So he's involved in this as well.
It's shot really well. And it's also, I think the best part about this film is the editing. in the pacing, which we'll get to, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's super colorful. Like, especially the print that I had. It's like really, the colors are really, like the blues and the greens are really, I wouldn't say oversaturated, but they're quite saturated. And the color's great. It really, in a typical Brian Trenchard-Smith way, it really shows off the locations that they're shooting from.
Yeah, it's a vibrant color palette. Like even the criminals are dressed very colorfully.
He's got the blue jacket and the yellow tie.
Yeah.
So this film's generally considered the film debut of Nicole Kidman. However, the movie Bush Christmas, which she also had a major role in, was in cinemas about a week earlier than this film. So it came out about a week earlier in December. Both these films were like Christmas releases in Australia and came out a bit earlier. But, you know, we can call it her first film, why not? And she was only 15 too when she shot this film. That's quite young, but she's taller than everyone in the movie, it seems like.
Yeah, I think because of her hair. She's got such a big hair.
She has very big hair in this movie. But she's also quite tall, which is she's very tall. I've never stood next to her, but she always looks tall. Poor Keith Urban, because I don't think he's super tall. But anyway,
I've my mother and maybe my boyfriend has, but I think she and Keith Urban live in Nashville now, and I think they've seen them out and about.
They've stayed together for a long time. Actually, it's been quite a. She's had a super interesting life, like. She was married to Tom Cruise and all that weird stuff.
I'm really curious, like, how they got started together, because I believe, if memory serves me right, he picked her to be in Days of Thunder, which I think was her first U.S. film.
I think so.
And so that is either where they met or where the relationship probably started to take off, because I think they were in, they play like Irish immigrants or something, like Far and Away or something like that.
Okay, yes, yeah.
And then the Kubrick film later.
Eyes
Wide Shut.
I know she's done lots of films, but I didn't realize it was so long.
She's done some really great like limited series and just like series for streaming services like what is that? Is it Big Little Lies, I think is what it is.
Big Little Lies. Did you see her in the Lucy thing? It wasn't bad. I know she got it got panned, I think, pretty much, but it wasn't a bad show. So
yeah, she's done some, you know, some questionable stuff. I remember she was in The Stepford Wives, which was critically panned, but she was in The Others, which is also like a great horror film.
Yeah, she's done some genre work. She's done, like, Dead Calm. She's in Dead Calm, which I think is a really good film that I'm looking at covering.
Is that the one with Sam Neill?
Yeah, I think so. And Billy Zane.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's on a yacht, and it's quite a good film as well. So, yeah, she's had quite a career. I'm sure people will tell us other stuff if they want. But
oh, sure.
she's done a lot. Brian Trenchard-Smith was hired for this film by the producers after they saw Turkey Shoot, which is totally mind-blowing, because Turkey Shoot is the absolute opposite to this movie in tone and in violence, etc. It's like absolutely opposite. But they were basically impressed in the way he handled the action sequences, and they knew there was going to be a lot of action in this.
That makes sense. I mean, I read that Russell Haag was set to direct this movie originally before he was replaced by someone else and then Brian Trenchard-Smith. So it was very, it reminded me of what happened with Frog Dreaming.
Same thing, wasn't it? Yeah. The other thing that happened is like the film was supposed to take place in Melbourne. And when they brought Brian Trenchard-Smith on board, he talked them around to relocating the movie in Sydney. Because of the scenery, et cetera. Not that Melbourne's a bad place. If you're listening and you're from Melbourne, Melbourne's great. I love Melbourne. I've been to Melbourne a few times. I was actually down there earlier this year. But I think he wanted to use some of the vistas in Sydney and the harbour and the ocean and the beaches and all that sort of stuff. They hired three professional BMX riders to perform the riding stunts. They couldn't find a female rider with the same body shape as Nicole Kidman, so her bike stunts were performed by an 18-year-old man wearing a wig.
I thought this was great because I was reading the Letterboxd reviews, and one of them read, BMX Bandits is edited so well, you'll believe Nicole Kidman can ride a bike.
I read that one as well. Yeah, it's really good. Some of the reviews are good. It's interesting though. Some of the reviews on Letterboxd are quite positive.
And yeah, I noticed
a lot of people are like, where has this movie been hiding? I had no idea about this movie. And I think some people have said Nicole Kidman's best film. I'm sure their tongue's firmly in their cheek, but
I mean, considering, I mean, she's quite good. I mean, we'll talk about that later, but. But yeah, I mean, I think she's definitely the standout.
Oh, 100%, yeah. I think originally, remembering, I was listening to the commentary, I think it was, and Trenchard Smith was kind of saying that when she came on board and when he started working with her, he changed things where out of the three protagonists in the movie, she kind of brought her to the fore more once he understood or saw that she could act, etc. So he gave her a bigger part in the movie. Nicole Kidman sprained her ankle in this movie. She jumped into an open grave during the cemetery scenes, which are cool scenes, and we'll talk about later. Her biggest concern though wasn't her sprained ankle. She was actually worried that she was going to get cut from the film because she wasn't able to ride a bike for a week or two. And Trenchard Smith kind of reassured her that she wasn't really in the movie for her bike riding abilities. He wanted her for acting. So he was talking in the commentary about the accident and taking her home that night to her family at about 2 a.m. and sort of saying to them, oh, the way he put it, he was like saying, here's your daughter. I'm sorry. I think I broke her a little bit. It was something like that. The film, you know, they moved the film to Sydney, and it was mostly shot in the northern suburbs of Sydney around the Manly area. Manly's like a area pretty much just across from, it's at the other side of Sydney Harbour sort of thing in regards to a ferry ride. It's probably about, I don't know, 15, 20 minute ferry ride from Sydney. It's a really nice ride to take. If you're ever visiting here, it's a really nice to get a ferry from Circular Quay in Sydney and go across to Manly. It's really, really nice and takes you across past the heads of Sydney so you can see out into the ocean, and it's just a really nice trip, really good. I haven't done that for years. I think last time I was in Manly, I probably drove. It'd be really nice one day to get on a ferry and actually do that again. So it's good. Yeah, I used to go to Manly quite a bit as a kid. They had an aquarium there for the longest time, which was like the only major aquarium in Sydney, Manly Aquarium. And then they have this area where you see in the movie a little bit, you'll see in the background like a Ferris wheel or something. They had like a little fun park on a pier at Manly. We used to go there a bit, and we used to just go and hang out. You know, when we'd be on school holidays, we'd often get the train into the city and get the ferry to Manly and just hang out and do stuff over there. So it's good.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it is nice. They might like it's a nice place. There used to be some saying about Manly. I can't remember what it's like, an old from the 40s or something, you know, 7 miles from Sydney, 1 million miles from Cairns or something like that. Something like that. I can't remember what it was. Yeah. Brian Trenchard Smith's son, Eric, is not credited in the credits, but he's in this movie. He's the little blonde haired boy in the shopping mall when they're doing the chase through the shopping mall. And he says something like, wow, BMX or something like that. I can't remember what it is. He's got that great bowl cut, the great bowl.
Yeah. Yeah. He stood out. I was like, oh, cute little kid there. You got to have that nice little insert shot.
It is. It's really good. And in the commentary, there's a section of the commentary where his son is in on the commentary with him around that area. And he sounds quite knowledgeable when it comes to BMX bikes. It sounds like he actually has some sort of history with them and things like that. It was quite interesting listening to him talk. And obviously, when he's on this commentary, he's like 27 years old or something like that. So Quentin Tarantino loves this movie, of course. He loves all Brian Trenchard-Smith movies, I think. And yeah. He describes BMX Bandits as Australia's version of the Goonies. And I think Trenchard-Smith says in the commentary or in the featurette that Trenchard-Smith said it's a better movie than Goonies, but I wasn't able to find any evidence of that. So I don't know if it's, you know, Brian pumping the movie up a little bit or he actually told him that or something like that. But he seems to love it. He showed it at like a, because of course he owns a print of this, and he showed it at some, like, I think some Austin film festival, like for children's films or kids' films or something like that, and he presented this movie for that.
That's interesting that Tarantino would make that comparison to the Goonies, because, I mean, I haven't seen the Goonies in a very long time, but it got me thinking about the kids versus criminals subgenre, if we want to call it that. Things like Home Alone, Blank Check, Three Ninjas, Surf Ninjas, the Goonies, of course. But this one reminded me a lot of Frog Dreaming in that it does some really cool and creative, like, genre blending. Like, my favorite bit was the spooky cemetery scene and how that shot, because it reminded me of Frog Dreaming when Henry Thomas, you know, he goes out onto that pier and he's looking for Charlie Pride, and it's just really moody. It's got a really great tone. And, you know, we've got action, of course, and a little bit of adventure, some horror, and a good dose of slapstick. I mean, it's a very curious but interesting mix.
Hmm. It is. And like the example you're pointing out is the shift in tone is interesting. Like, mm-hmm. like you were saying, that the Frog Dreaming scene with Charlie Pride, looking for Charlie Pride and going out on that pier, it's actually quite a spooky scene. And then we've got this scene in the cemetery, and it is a massive tonal shift in the movie.
Yeah, it feels like a totally different movie, because about at the 1 hour mark, we get almost a 10-minute chase scene. And it, I mean, it's well done, but it's a very long
chase. It's a long scene, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it goes through a water park and a rugby game and a rock quarry. Yes. But it's shot really well and it's edited really well. So, I mean, it's got a nice pace to it. But comparing that to the cemetery scene, it's just, yeah, it's night and day.
Frog Dreaming probably, for me, is probably a little bit more serious, is the wrong word, but it has a little bit more depth and a little bit more kind of, I don't know, there's references to, like, the Aboriginal people and stuff like that, which is quite interesting. Whereas this one is more a typical kids movie that's kind of has a lot of slapstick elements, like you said. I mean, look at the final scene of the movie where they're this big foam bath, right?
Yeah, that's how we're going to thwart the bad guys. We're going to just douse them in a fertilizer foam.
In a fertilizer foam, I'm thinking, hang on, who wants to be in fertilizer foam? And don't light a match if it's fertilizer foam. Jeez.
Right.
Don't drive cars into it. So,
anyway. I was like, well, that's the end of the movie.
That's the end of the movie, yeah. Let's get onto the music. I think this movie is short. There's a couple of notes, and it's interesting. The music is by Colin Steed and Frank Strangio, I think his name is. So Frank Strangio also composed the score for Dead End Drive-In in 1986. I love the score of Dead End Drive-In. This one I don't mind so much. It's very much of its time, and it's very much that kids' movie, kind of exciting BMX sort of music, you know, in the background. It's quite good. The only thing that drove me nuts in this movie was all the whooshing when the bike.
Yeah, lots of whooshing.
It was everywhere. but it was good. I didn't mind the score. The song is a bit there. I don't even understand the song. It was like it. I think they're saying BMX or something in there, and
yeah,
that grated on my nerves a little bit, especially in the like the home screen on the Blu-ray. It just sort of goes over and over all the time. What did you think of the music?
I feel very much the same way. I mean, it was very dated, but also, yeah, I mean, it was appropriate for, you know, the chase scenes in particular. And I like that it shifted with the tone of the story whenever we get into the cemetery, because the music there also has this heightened sense of danger and ominence. And I thought that degree of versatility there was, I noticed that as well. And I thought that little bit was pretty good. But yeah, I mean, otherwise it's pretty unremarkable score.
Yeah, it's functional. It's good. Yeah, yeah. The other thing I learned last night is the American rock band Wheatus, the teenage dirtbag guys, had a song called BMX Bandits on their album Too Soon Monsoon. And they dedicated the song to Nicole Kidman, and it includes the lyrics, "Hey Nicole," in the chorus. I had a look at the video. I checked it out on YouTube last night. It's quite interesting. Actually, the song's actually not too bad either. And in the video itself, it's an animated sort of music video. There's an animated caricature of Nicole Kidman in the video.
I'm sure she's very flattered.
I'm sure she is. So that's one of the things I wanted to talk about, is she never talks about this movie or hardly ever talks about this movie at all. And she's usually pushes it aside. If you hear people asking her about it, she doesn't really say much. There was a recent interview, I think, when she was promoting the Lucy thing. Is it, what was it? Something about the Ricardos was the name of the movie on Netflix or whatever it was. And she made some comment about it, but once again, she always seems to just like change the subject whenever she can, which is a bit odd because, like, from all the reviews I've read, a lot of people kind of like her in this role and think that, you know, for her age, that she did really well. I think she did quite well in the role, and, you know, I don't know in this that you can actually see the seeds of the actress she turned into. And listening and watching the featurette on the Blu-ray, a couple of producers, when they, you know, were obviously asked about it, sort of said, well, she was very good, but we didn't see anything that kind of pointed to this amazing career she was going to have. So, but yeah, she tends to dismiss it. She mentioned it a couple of years ago when Australia won a medal or something in BMX at the Olympics or something like that, and she put on a BMX Bandits T-shirt for some sort of promotional thing, and the person that won the medal apparently said that she was so flattered because BMX Bandits was one of her favorite films. So she doesn't really. I don't think. It's one of those movies, you know, how you find a lot of actors kind of just a lot of their earlier films that are, you know, Kevin Bacon never talks about Friday the 13th, right? So,
yeah, it's one of I've noticed that a lot of actors, like, they, like, to them, that's just a job that they did decades ago. And they're like, well, what about this more recent thing that I've done? And let's talk about the things that I'm doing now and the things that I want to do. Like, that was in the past and that's not me anymore. But I mean, there are even some actors who refuse to watch their own movies. And there are some who quite enjoy that and find it a very, you know, kind of educational experience. As like, you know, an athlete would review, you know, tape of their, you know, running plays in football or something.
So let's have a quick chat about the film. What were your initial thoughts on the film?
Well, my first impression or my first thought was Trenchard Smith is great at filming things that go fast. So we've got cars, we've got bikes, boats, and people on water slides. And I just was impressed with how the action and suspense is created and maintained here, particularly through the editing, as I've said. And just that kind of dose of humor here and there, these little exchanges that are pretty comical in the dialogue and in the slapstick, like in the cemetery when the bad guys get boinked in the face with their latex masks and the nose pops out, or one gets poked in the eye with a walkie-talkie antenna, or that mannequin lands on the priest early in the film. Like, just little things like that. And there's that montage, that musical montage of the kids doing bike tricks. And it reminded me of like a chewing gum commercial from the 80s.
Brian Trenchard Smith is very good at this. And he even, in his usual way, blows up a car in this movie. He can't help himself, basically. He has to blow something up. And I think, as he always says, you know, when in doubt, blow it up.
Right.
I don't think there's a movie I've seen of his where he doesn't blow something up.
Well, when did you first see this movie?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't think I've seen this movie. I was thinking this when I was watching it, and I was like, have I ever actually seen this movie? It's been in, like, in my psyche for a long time in regards to, you know, I've always known of the movie and knew that Nicole Kidman was in it and all this sort of stuff. But I was like, I'm not sure I actually ever saw this movie until I sat down to watch it for the first time last week. And I was racking my brain. And I may have maybe caught some of it on TV at some stage or something, like, because there was a few things that were familiar to me. But the cemetery scene wasn't familiar to me at all or anything like that. So I actually don't think I've seen the movie before last week.
So was it what you expected or no?
It was exactly what I expected, I guess, because I knew it was kind of like a teen movie / kids movie, family movie. So I didn't expect it to be like to have a lot of depth. I didn't expect it to have much violence, although, as we'll talk later, there's guns involved in this movie. It was pretty much like I expected. It's a fun romp, and Nicole Kidman's good in it. The two other leads, the two guys that are with her, aren't too bad either. I think they're pretty good in this film. And the criminals are just like slapstick. There's no real threat at all. Even when one of them is holding a knife to Nicole Kidman, he's holding it so far away, it's hardly threatening anyway. But I'm sure they did that so they would still get a G rating.
In that scene, when that guy is holding that switchblade to Nicole Kidman, he backs up. His eyes never leave her. He backs up and steps backwards up onto the roof of the car and drops in through the skylight or the sunroof. And that's how he gets back into the car. That was incredibly impressive.
There's some really fun stuff in this movie like that. Like, apparently, did you notice every time they got in the car, rubbish fell out of the car? So that was their running gag for the whole movie, that every time the car was opened up, there would be rubbish would fall out of the car. And it does. Every time they open a door, junk falls out of the car. And the whole thing about, you know, where David Argue's character wants to drive the car all the time and never gets to drive. And then when he does get to drive the car, he's running into things and having a great time doing it, sort of thing. It's
right.
It's a fun movie. It's really a fun movie. And I think even kids like today would have a good time with it. It's very dated. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, it's very 80s, especially when they go into that shopping mall, which is Warringah Mall in Sydney. When they go into that mall, you can tell by the shops and what's being sold and the fittings and whatnot that we're just on the other side of the 70s, only just on the other side of the 70s. And you can really definitely see it. I mean, these movies for me are always a bit of a time capsule. You know, when I see, I saw glimpses of a department store called Grace Brothers, which no longer exists, but I worked at when I first left school. Then there's things like I think I saw in this one a Knock and Kirby's, which is an old hardware store that chain that ran from years ago, stuff like that. And you see all that sort of stuff and you just think, well, this is pretty much my childhood or my young, late teens, early adult years in this whole movie. So a lot of these films for me are a bit of a flashback to those days. Yeah, it's a good movie. I like it. I like the bits in the hangar while they were just driving around in the hangar chasing the kids on the bikes, and which was only shot because of the fact that they were supposed to do more chase scenes outside, but it was raining. And then Trenchard Smith saw this hangar that was near one of the shooting locations and said, why don't we shoot in there? So they went in there and shot that whole chase scene in there. So, yeah, it's good.
Yeah, I like the water park.
Oh, the water park thing's great. I think the thing Trenchard Smith said, I must have said his name a million times over this episode, but anyway, it's his movie, said is they wanted to put BMX bikes in places where they normally wouldn't go. And you can see that in this movie. And when he knew about, when he heard about the water slide, he was like, oh, can we take the bikes down there as part of a chase? They don't necessarily ride the bikes through there, but they take the bikes through the water slide.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, just because, you know, you have to have a camera operator there too.
Yeah.
Guy going, that, I don't know, that just, they must have had to have had like really great insurance because that just seemed so dangerous.
You would think so. And it's amazing they got all those kids to come out at the same time. The three kids all come out at the same time. Like, I'm not sure how they timed that. There was enough movement that they didn't just sort of sit near the end and then come out. It looks like they all came out with a fair bit of momentum behind them. So they must have come from a height, unless they stopped them halfway or something like that. But I don't know. It was quite good. And the way that the Krim comes out, he goes down there as well. And he gets up after he's come out and he straightens up his jacket and does his tie up. And he's so
great.
It's such a kid's movie. I mean, as the whole thing was really kids love seeing adults, you know, not being true adults or not being adults and being, you know, one-upped by the kids, that sort of thing. So obviously that's a big thing in these sort of movies as well.
Yeah, like, as you said, like the bad guys don't seem all that threatening, even though they have guns and knives and stuff. But you never really feel like any of the children are in peril. You know, like there's really no sense of like these people are going to murder these children. It's not like in Home Alone, for example, you know, at the end of the movie, we have Joe Pesci threatening to bite off the fingers of Macaulay Culkin. Or in the second movie, at the end, he's got a gun and he's telling Kevin he's going to shoot him in the head and stuff in Central Park. And you're like, as a kid, you're like, holy shit, that's pretty intense, you know, but that's a family movie, a Christmas movie.
Yeah, there's no stakes in this movie, really. I mean, there's a few scenes where, like we mentioned, they're, you know, in a bit of trouble, but, you know, you always feel like they're going to get out of it. And I think, but that's the way it's meant to be. It's a G-rated film, right? One of the things I wanted to talk about was, like, what do you think? Like, I was listening to the producers talk about Nicole Kidman and, you know, like, what they saw in her and did they have it. And it's always interesting when you watch the first film or one of the first films by someone that ends up being a star, much like, I guess, we talked about Kevin Bacon, Friday the 13th, a few of those sort of actors. Do you see anything in these performances that lead you to believe that they're going to be the stars they are? It's hard. I think it's harder in hindsight, in a way, to kind of make that call.
Yeah, I mean, I thought about this for a while, and I think her performance here, like, what's great about it is that, one, she has great line delivery. I think those lines that are dripping with sarcasm or annoyance, but she can be scared and exasperated, vulnerable, witty. Like, she shows a great deal of range here. And I think the script allows her to do that. And I think probably Trenchard Smith allowed her to do that too. And I think that's why you said, you know, he tried to bring her more to the forefront. Mm. And, you know, she has great chemistry with the younger cast. And I think especially in that scene towards the end, after she's been kidnapped and she's in the car, and I think she's talking about like a scary movie or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a great little bit. And she's really good. And I think that she had a lot of opportunity in this movie to show off, you know, or to demonstrate what her chops were at the time, and that, or that she had potential to do bigger and better things. Mm. And so, yeah, that's the best answer I could give.
Like I said, I think it's hard in hindsight to, because you know how big she is already. So I think when I think about that, I think about what the producers said, and which was, when they watched the film after it was released or when it was being cut, et cetera, they didn't see anything, or most of them didn't see anything that said to them, oh, this person's going to be a big star. They just thought she was putting in a good performance. So,
yeah.
The other thing was that it was really important for this film to get a G rating. So a G rating in Australia is like everyone can go see it. It doesn't really matter. You can be five, whatever. You can see the movie. So they wanted this movie to play over the Christmas holidays, which is probably the busiest time for movies in Australia, because it's in Australia we have school terms. They have four terms a year, and the breaks between the terms are probably only 2 weeks generally. And then at Christmas there's a break that pretty much school goes off maybe a week before, a couple of, I don't know, I'm not a parent of a school child anymore. Isn't that awful? But school goes off at about, I think, a week or a few days before Christmas, and then doesn't come back till pretty much the end of January there. So it's a 6 week break. And it's really, movies in that time are really, that's when all the family movies usually hit. I think it was interesting that Trenchard Smith said that he thought he was fortunate to get a G rating for the film because he used guns and knives in the film. And even that, the first scene where they, or the second or third scene where they actually rob the bank and they drive the van through the bank and they pull out the big shotguns and they're kind of, you know, pointing guns at people and threatening people and things like that. He was concerned that, you know, that they won't, you know, get the rating they wanted to get, and he was quite happy they did. And the scene in the cemetery is, I think, if you're like a 5-year-old kid seeing that movie, that might be a bit scary, or even a kid, you know, maybe under 10, I guess. It might be these days, no, but back then might be a little bit scary. So interesting to see whether he got a bit of a dream run with the censors. It's reasonably consistent with a G rating, but I think, you know, there was obviously some chance that it might have got a PG or something like that, which they didn't want.
Yeah, well, my first question is, what was Jaws rated in Australia?
Was it? That's interesting. I think it might have been PG.
It was rated PG in the States. I was just curious to see if it was any different in Australia.
I'm just having a quick look, actually. 1975. Well, it's rated MA 15+ now, which is interesting.
Hmm.
I'm not sure what it was when it came out. It might have been even M. I'm not going to run out and look at my Australian poster, but that's interesting, because when I look up Jaws on just in Google, it says MA 15, which is like, you know, 15 plus, right? What does it say on IMDb? It's probably going to say MA 15, isn't it? Yeah, because there was movies like that, right, where they were quite violent movies, but they were given lesser of a rating at the time, right?
Yeah, like I was thinking, like Jaws was PG in the States. This was before the PG-13 rating.
Yeah,
and I mean, my goodness, like that's horrifying. like oh my God, like if I took a child to see that today, like there's no way like a kid, you know, under 13 would be admitted on their own. And, but then again, I was thinking, okay, also in 82, Tron, if you've seen the original Disney Tron, it's rated PG as well. And they're like video game characters fighting each other. And there's like three curse words. There's damn is said three times. And that's the most offensive part of that movie. And I'm like, how did those two movies both have the same rating? It was just totally beyond me.
Is damn still an issue in the US? Because I remember that was always an issue with people. Like, you could say, and this might be just my limited worldview or just the old me, but I'm sure there was a period where you could say the word shit, but damn was a bit of a problem, like even on TV in the US and stuff like that.
Yeah, I know that like movies that were, I guess, not suitable for children that were aired on network TV, like that were dubbed, or, you know, like the curse words were dubbed over. Like hell, damn, shit, fuck, all of that was replaced. I remember, this is crazy, but I remember seeing the TV broadcast of RoboCop in the late 80s, and the word scumbag was replaced with sleazebag.
Oh, really? It's hardly a difference, but yeah.
Right, yeah. So I thought that was very curious. But now on TV you can get away with a lot more. I mean, you can hear damn and shit, hell and bitch. You hear that all the time on network TV, I think. So it's definitely a lot more lax than it once was. But I think in the 80s, yeah, it was still very, like, still yeah, we, tight. You know, very yeah. conservative, yeah.
Yeah. I know on TV here, I mean, you can watch TV after 8:30 in Australia and you're going to hear the word fuck.
Oh, wow.
Quite often.
I had a thought, Pete, because I know at one point I'd seen Brian Trenchard-Smith called, like, you know, the Spielberg of Australia. And I thought, I had this image in my head of him re-releasing this movie, but using CGI to replace the guns like Spielberg did with E.T. Right. Do you remember when that happened?
I did. I remember the uproar. There was quite an uproar, right?
There was, yeah, because he CGI'd like the guns that the government people were carrying and replaced them with walkie-talkies. But, of course, that wouldn't work for this movie because that would create too much confusion. There's enough walkie-talkies
Yeah. I think one of the things that, that caused this not to work as well in the US, I think they had another name for it in the US, and it had to do with the walkie-talkies. As well,
it was called shortwave or something,
shortwave or wavelength or something like that, which made no sense. Imagine going in thinking you're going to see a movie about walkie talkies or something, then it's all BMX bikes.
I know, I'm thinking robots, like I'm thinking Short Circuit or something.
There's a few scenes in this I like. I think we talked about the water slide, I think that's a really good scene. I think both of us, that cemetery scene is something that really stood out, like you said, for the tonal shift, plus just the way it was shot, right?
Yeah, this moodiness and just the sense of foreboding and the criminals in masks, like the way they were shot and the way they were lit and the way they would creep up on the kids and stuff. Like, that was pretty creepy stuff, you know? And like we said, the music amplified that. And then next thing you know, everything's bright and sunny and colorful again, and we're bebopping along on our bikes and whooshing all over the place.
Whooshing everywhere. And there's a scene in the cemetery. There's that touching little scene where, what's the actor's name? Is it, I know the actor's name. I'm trying to think of the character's name, where he and Nicole Kidman's character are down in the grave, in the dug grave.
Oh,
And he has this little moment with her.
Yeah. I think his name was Goose.
That's it, Goose. Yeah, and her name was Judy, right?
Judy.
Yeah, there's that little scene there where he gets friend-zoned rather badly.
yeah, and me and Goose, we would be fast friends, like, because he's always like, this reminds me of that movie, you know, that drive-in movie, Kiss the Blood Off My Carburetor. I want to see that movie.
In the commentary, Brian Trenchard-Smith said he'd love to make that movie. And I'm like, you probably would.
He would, yeah.
I actually like the leads in this. Like, I think they're all pretty likable, like as the mm-hmm. the three kids. PJ, I think the other actor's name, the other guy's name is. That's the Angelo D'Angelo, which is an interesting
great
name,
yeah.
To say the least. Yeah. But his character's quite good. I think he's the character that Nicole Kidman kind of has eyes for, but it's never really explored in the movie. They definitely keep it very G-rated, the whole movie.
Yeah.
There's one line in the movie, I'm trying to think of it off the top of her head, where she says something about the three of them together. She says, well, you know what they say, two's company, three gets us talked about, which I think is quite a funny line.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. It's good.
What this movie doesn't have, is you know how a lot of kids' movies have almost like a level above the kids' heads for adults? This movie doesn't have a lot of that.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, there should be, or there's often in this type of movie, some humor, you know, some jokes, things that, yeah, that a younger audience would not pick up on, but the adults would be like, I get that. So there's a little nugget, a little treat for them in the when they're watching the movie. But yeah, we don't really have a lot of that here. I can't think of anything.
I think that's the closest line.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't really have anything. That line maybe, because like that's kind of pointed. But even then, the criminals in this movie are quite interesting. The fellow that plays like the criminal boss guy, his name is Brian Marshall. He was apparently in The Spy Who Loved Me? He was in one of the Bond movies not long before this. And he was a Brit that came to Australia and lived in Australia and decided to live in Australia. And Brian Trenchard-Smith thought, great, he's in Australia, I'm going to hire him to do this movie. And I thought he was quite good. He's a bit funny in this movie. He's kind of half serious, half funny. The whole piece, you know, when they're driving in the truck and he's kind of complaining about how he used to live in Britain and he thought he'll come to Australia and he'll have the good life and this whole thing.
Yeah.
So he made all that up. He came to Brian Trenchard-Smith and said, oh, I've got this little thing I want to do in the truck that's talking about how I used to have it good and now I came here thinking it was going to be great and all this crap. So that was all made up by him. That's a great little scene too, actually.
Born and bred in Stoke Newington. Respected in Hackney. Fated in Tottenham. Little bit of bother, come to Australia. Land of opportunity, the lucky country. Lucky I should come to. What have I copped for out here? Pair of dummies. Kids on bikes. And I look like I've fell out the back of a baker's van!
That reminds me, he has a great line there towards the end in the truck when Judy has been talking about some horror movie and he says something about, what's with these parents? Like, don't they care what their kids are watching and stuff like that? I was like, just those kinds of moments are really quite funny.
And then listening to John Lay's character when she's telling that story, I think they're in the car when she's been kidnapped the first time.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And she's telling the story, and John Lay's character, who's called Mustache in this movie, is because he's got a big mustache, I guess, is listening intently and really wants to hear the end of the story. It's very typical kids movie where they almost kind of like are a bunch of friends, but you know she's been kidnapped basically.
Yeah, and it's the ending is so. I mean, we've talked about it a little bit, but the ending is just. It's so bonkers, you know, I mean, it's so lighthearted and almost absurd because you have like 100 kids on bikes and they're all like rallied together to take down the bad guys and it all ends in a fertilizer bubble bath. And that's the way the movie carries us out. It's a very memorable image, but it does just kind of, it ends with a bang somewhat. I mean, it's not a fiery explosion, but an explosion of bubbles.
Yeah, it's a bit I actually thought it was a bit jarring because when I got there, I thought, oh, this is the end, right?
Yeah, it does just kind of end.
It just kind of ends. And abrupt. They had the whole thing with all the fertilizer foam. And then they have that slapsticky 1920s kind of comedy music over the background that. And I'm like, oh my God. So we've had this whole movie with this cool BMX music and all this sort of stuff. And then we get this weird kind of, I call it Charlie Chaplin music. Yeah. At the end sort of thing, right? And it's kind of weird. It's a bit weird. And I thought it was a bit jarring myself. And then we cut, obviously, to the bit where they've got some reward money for stopping this robbery and they have their own BMX bike track at the end and they're having competition.
Oh, so. Right. I had it in my mind before I went into this movie that that's what this movie was going to be about. It was going to be more about, like, competitive, you know, BMX bike sport kind of thing, like competitive racing or something. But I guess that's probably what the sequel would have been.
I think I read something online where there was some talk about a sequel, but I'm not sure if it's just online talk or not. So,
oh, wouldn't that be something? Let's bring Nicole back.
Imagine bringing Nicole Kidman back.
Make it a.
How would they do that?
Make it a limited series.
Yeah. How would they do that? Maybe they would make her like the mother of a new sort of like BMX kind of, you know, generation.
Yeah, like, so she owns the bike race park or track or whatever, and the rest of the her partners have kids, and they get in trouble with some bad guys, and yeah, the whole thing like one more time.
And she ended up marrying one of the guys that she was with in the movie and or something like
right.
that. And,
you know. Yeah.
Or the classic, you know, they own the BMX track, but they're going to go out of business unless they have some
right.
sort of big thing and all the kids come together. And
yeah, they come across some heist money and they're like, this is what we're going to use to buy the racetrack or to save the racetrack. And then the bad guys come after them for it.
Yeah. They stumble across a meth lab.
Oh, yeah. Let's really modernize it.
Yeah.
Bring in some social commentary.
Disney would make it. So
probably wouldn't get that G rating.
That's it. We've already written it. Brian Trenchard-Smith, we can write
yeah.
it. You can make it. Yeah. The other scene I love, because I've just got the trailers on auto-repeat here on IMDb, the scene on the motorboat when they're driving that, go to the motorboat and the way that David Argue's character falls into the esky on the motorboat when the motorboat takes off. Remember that?
Yeah.
There's a scene where they're in that like really hot racing boat or whatever it
yeah.
is. And he gets in it and I'm like, geez. And that's quite a pratfall. I thought he did that really well. It was all planned out apparently because I watched it and I said to May, I said, was that meant to happen? Did he fall like that? But apparently it was all planned.
Yeah, I mean, I know I said like the action and stuff is really great here, but the stunts are really great. They're top tier. They're really, really awesome.
What are your final thoughts on the film?
Final thoughts. I mean, it's like you said, it's fun. It's pretty shallow. I mean, there's not a lot to really take in here. If you have kids, they'll probably really enjoy it. Otherwise, I mean, you're probably watching it for nostalgia, just that time and place. But I mean, it's a lot of fun, you know, but watch it on a weekend if it's a rainy day.
It is a fun movie to watch. And if you're a bit older like myself, it's a nice blast from the past. And like you said, on a wet Saturday afternoon, if you've got the kids at home and they're not sure what to watch, stick it on, put it on, go onto Netflix and check it out, or just check it out anyway. And watch Nicole Kidman do her thing before she became famous and get her hair goes from being really curly to almost rat tails. And I don't know what's going on with it.
Oh gosh. Yeah. That hair.
And then when you see the scenes where it's obviously that stunt double guy wearing a curly hair wig.
Oh, right.
It's kind of good. I must say they did those transitions between the stunt riders and the actors quite well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's also a testament to the editing. Yeah, all of that flows together so seamlessly that your brain is tricked. Like, you're not so concerned with picking up, okay, where's the stunt rider? Where's Nicole? Like, it's a seamless transition, so you totally believe that she can ride a bike.
The big question, BMX Bandits or Frog Dreaming for the Brian Trenchard-Smith family movie?
Oh, Frog Dreaming all the way. I mean, it's got a lot more depth, but also it has mystery and intrigue and adventure and, you know, you want to know what that thing is in the quarry there.
To be fair too, Frog Dreaming is a few years after this, so I think there's also been some, he's had some experience and this may well have, you know, there may have been things in this movie he thought he could have done better, and once he got to Frog Dreaming, he kind of was able to do that. I think Frog Dreaming has heaps more depth in it than this movie.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And it would have been interesting to see Henry Thomas and Nicole Kidman in Frog Dreaming if they'll met at the same time. That would have been interesting.
That would have been cool.
But, yeah, I think Frog Dreaming for me is definitely the one when it comes to Brian Trenchard-Smith family movies. I don't think he's done – he may have done some in his later years, some family kind of movies, but these are the only two that really stand out to me, and they're only two Australian ones that I can think of. Hmm. I don't think he's done many others. But anyway, it's a massive departure from Turkey Shoot and everything else he's done. I didn't mind it, but I think, yeah, Frog Dreaming's definitely the way to go. If you're choosing between the two, I'd go for Frog Dreaming or whatever it was called in the US, The Quest.
The Quest,
right?
Yeah. And also I think it has more like rewatch value. Like I feel like the more times you see BMX Bandits, you're not going to get any more you know, that you didn't get the first time. Whereas I think Frog Dreaming has enough layers that you're going to find something new and interesting the next time you watch it.
Yeah, for sure. Now just talking about it again, I kind of want to go and watch it again.
I do
again,
too. That's
good. All right. So what have you been up to? Are you having anything, you got anything new coming out, Varicom Video? Gory Picture Show, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, the Gory Picture Show. We have a new episode out, or it's coming out very shortly. It'll probably be up by the time this episode is out. It's on Slime City. And then we, over at Varicon Video, we have an episode on The Fifth Element, which will be coming out very soon, too.
Keeping you busy then.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so thank you very much for coming on the show, Brandon. It's great to have you on again, and hearing your thoughts and having a discussion with you about these movies. It's great fun.
Yeah, no, I had a great time as always. I appreciate you inviting me once again.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We'll talk soon. And when we return, we'll talk about what's coming up next.
And now, preview time. When it comes to entertainment, you can't beat a good film. So let's take a look at what's coming your way.
She was alone. They were renegades. She became the target of their savage hunt. She was fair game.
Next on A Dingo Ate My Movie, I'm joined for the first time by Angie Frasori to discuss Fair Game from 1986. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode. Thank you to all my guests who give their time to make this podcast possible, and a special thanks to you for listening. Don't forget you can follow A Dingo Ate My Movie on social media. We're at Dingo Movie on Twitter, Dingo Movie Pod on Facebook and Instagram, and we're on the web at dingomoviepod.com. If you'd like to support the show, leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, or share the show with your friends.
Of course, you can always buy me a coffee over at buymeacoffee.com/dingomoviepod. Once again, thanks for listening, stay safe, and I'll see you on the next episode of A Dingo Ate My Movie.